Hello and welcome to the Combat and Classics Podcast. This is Brian Wilson in Dallas, Texas.
Shiloh Brooks at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey.
And Jeff Black at St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland.
We are at the end of Homer's Iliad, book 24. I am, forgive me, listeners, going to give a summary. And, Jeff is going to do the opening question. So, book 24, we just finished the funeral games in 23, and Achilles is sad again and weeps. We get some Paris backstory, which I love, you know, the throwing in the flashbacks in the last bit of any work of art. Apollo speaks up for Hector because Achilles has still just let the body sit out and dragged it around for 12 days now. So Apollo speaks up to the gods and says, hey, this is wrong. Hera opposes Apollo, and then Zeus has an idea and sends Thetis to talk to Achilles, sends Iris to talk to Priam to say, hey, bring some stuff, give some gifts, and go to Achilles and get your son back. The Hermes helps Priam get to Achilles' tent. Priam supplicates himself, just barges into Achilles' tent and supplicates himself. They have a cry, and then Achilles gives Priam Hector's body back. Priam sleeps or goes to sleep in Achilles' tent, but then is fearful in the night and skedaddles out in the middle of the night, takes Hector's body back to Troy. And we get a few speeches, we get some talking, and then we get the last line of the book, which we'll just tease you with. We'll do it at the end so we don't spoil it, or we'll just mention it at some random point because I'll forget that I said we're going to mention it at the end. So, Jeff, over to you for the opening question.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, so if you have just listened to our previous pod, you'll know that a thought I was kind of pushing when we were talking about book 23 was that this was what I called Achilles' domestic policy, how Achilles wants to treat his fellow Greeks, his fellow Achaeans, now that his wrath has run its course, and he is however he's become after having been wrathful. And this book I'm inclined to put under the heading of Achilles' foreign policy, right? In other words, what does Achilles think of Troy and the Trojans now that his wrath has run its course? So it makes a pair, not only because we have the funerals of Patroclus and the funerals of Hector in the last two books to close out the Iliad, but also because we have this kind of double consideration of Achilles' disposition towards those on his side and those on the opposing side. And so in the context of that, here's my question. Why does Achilles give back the body of Hector to Priam? I'll just say that the passage where he agrees, when Thetis arrives and Achilles agrees to Zeus's idea, is very uninformative. Achilles essentially says, so be it. So why does he agree? Any ideas?
Are you going to tell us that it's because there's this great decline in the Greek people? And there's this whole moral decline, and they're all about, I mean, because you could say, well, enough is enough. I mean, I don't know. You could just say, you know, Achilles is not a unsensible man, and Priam's appeal is not unreasonable. He's had his way. I mean, he's drugged the guy around the back of his chariot for a while. I mean, you know, it's not unsatisfying what he's managed to do. I mean, it's too bad that Hector's body can't be mutilated a little more, maybe, or something like that, unfortunately. But on the other hand, maybe this goes back to what you were saying last time, and there's a certain kind of changing of the guard, changing of the generations. I don't know. What do you have in mind? Or his rage seems to have is gone. I mean, this is not something that a person who's raging would do. I don't know.
Well, maybe a place to begin in what you said was just whether he is in fact satisfied, right? The notion that enough is enough, I find interesting and opaque, right? Because it doesn't mean you need to know. You might feel like it's not enough, but you need to recognize when it is enough. So your dissatisfaction with the situation is not really an adequate indicator of when things, when justice really has been done, right? So the particular case would be Achilles is still out there dragging Hector's body around Patroclus's tomb, and it just the body just does not seem to be getting mutilated. And so he should recognize from that that there's nothing more that can be done. And if there's nothing more that can be done to rectify Patroclus's death or to compensate for Patroclus's death, then he should let it go, right? That that might be one line of thinking that would explain why he gives the body back. Does that ring true?
Well, there's also, I mean, I suppose that, and also there's been an eye for an eye exchange. You got yours, you got my Patroclus, now I've buried him. All right, you can have yours back. Like, you know, I mean, we're even Steven now or something mm-hmm. like this. Mm-hmm. You
know, yeah.
Not inconceivable.
This may be annoying to you guys and others on the pod, but it also just makes a lot better story, right?
Yeah.
We've got the foreshadowing in the previous book because Achilles is just giving stuff away to people that don't even participate who are old, right? Nestor gets an urn and wasn't even in the chariot race. Priam gets his son's body back and never fought in the war, right? And so from a neat little storytelling, you know, piece, and also, you know, what a wonderful dramatic ending. That in this book that is about mostly war and slaughter, and that's what we've seen most of the time, we have these two characters, Achilles and Priam, weeping together at the end for the death of their most cherished loved one. And Achilles shows a little bit of pity mm-hmm. and gives the body back. So it's a lovely story, and we get I love the fact that we get Helen shows up. Notionally, this is a book about Helen nice. And about Helen being the cause of the war, and we haven't seen her since like book 9 or something like that. She hasn't gotten any lines, and so Helen just pops back in right at the end and says that she's been there for 20 years, so adds a little bit of complexity to the plot. And raises some more questions as to like 20, you've been there 20 years.
yeah.
And we get this lovely little, you know, very heartfelt. Yeah. It's not like Lifetime, you know, heartfelt ending, but it feels good. Like yeah. It feels nice.
You were the favorite of my husband's brothers. No, right? Oh yeah. Okay.
Is it what's going on, Jeff, in some ways, is this that Priam makes Achilles feel what Priam feels. So he says, look, you think about your dad. Like, think about how it's going to, you know, think about that. And so there's this mirroring, but it's also the case that both of them have a body of the other that's very valuable, or have had in the past the body mm-hmm. of the other that's very mm-hmm. valuable. And so, I'm not persuaded that this is some kind of a decline so much as it is simply a manifestation of a kind of human nature. In other mm-hmm. words, they both are able to feel what the other feels, not because they're now morally perverse and the bow is no longer tense in the war, mm-hmm. but they're two men and they're the same of the same flesh and blood and psychic drives. And they look at each other and say, you're me and I'm you in an odd way. I mean, yeah. Not exactly accurate, but there's this attempt to show that. And no. That's not strictly pity. That's, you know, it doesn't have to be. That doesn't have to be the cause of the mutual fellow feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely right about the mirroring, that they see in each other themselves. And the only thing I'd add is I do think it's pity. That's being mirrored. In fact, I think it's self-pity. So let me give a couple details from 24 that I think are relevant. And, you know, this might be special pleading in the sense that I'm just picking out the details that support my interpretation. But Priam is a dead man. He knows that with Hector gone, Troy is going to fall. In fact, all his good sons are gone, according to him. He says something like, you know, I had 50 sons, and all that I've got left to me, and this turn of phrase just grabbed me, all I've got left to me are liars and dancers. By the way, that's not a bad description to my mind of the people who seem to prevail in the funeral games in book 23. So I'm inclined to say that liars and dancers are the people who are kind of taking over the world on both sides as a result of Achilles' wrath. But the other thing that Priam says is that if I go and Achilles kills me, as long as I get to hold the body of Hector before that happens, I'm fine. In fact, it might even be better if he kills me than that if he lets me go back to Troy and then I die there. And here my memory might be failing me, whether I'm remembering the Odyssey or the Aeneid, but my memory is that Priam's death, what actually happens to him in the story as Troy is sacked, is really terrible. I think he is eaten by dogs, at least in one of the accounts. His own dogs set on him, if I remember correctly. So, you know, dying at Achilles' hands might actually not be the worst outcome. And Priam is aware of this. So I do think there's a mirroring going on, but I think it's a mirroring of two people who have said goodbye to life. And maybe just one more piece of evidence I think speaks in this direction. When Achilles is giving this history lesson to Priam, that Brian was mentioning, I think, on the previous pod, one of the things he says is Zeus has two urns, you know, good things and bad things. And he does one of two things. He either gives you mixtures of good and bad or all bad. Right? There's no possibility. I think he leaves out the alternative that Zeus could give somebody all good. And so I just, these things start to stack up for me. And I think the beginning of the exchange of bodies is that, or the exchange of Hector's body, is that this is an exchange between two people who are done with life. And they know it.
Yeah. Okay. I don't disagree with the facts as you presented them. But I don't see why then the conclusion has to be a moral decay into like a prefigured Christian pity. Because... Isn't there another option, which is this is far from being a certain sort of Christian decay. This is an example of a glorious moment in the tragic age of the Greeks. That is to say, we humans have come to terms with the terrifying nature of the situation in which we find ourselves. I see it, Priam. You see it too. The women at the end see it, and it's not about pity. It's a shocking understanding of the meaninglessness of the situation that we've been engaged in over the past 20 years, that it's resulted in death of all of our friends and loved ones, enslavement of our wives. Take the gold. It doesn't matter. Isn't this horrible? Look, that's life. That's our lot as human beings. Meanwhile, Athena and Zeus are hanging out. And so I don't see why there can't be this almost joyful celebration of the terrible nature of life. Why it couldn't be interpreted, at least in some ways, through that lens, and why it has to be interpreted through the moral decay lens. Do you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I do.
Because I'm on board with the facts as you're lining them up.
Yeah. Well, and maybe we could kind of come to terms in the sense that, you know, maybe I would call it tragic, this insight that they both seem to have. Maybe there's some benefit to the tragic insight that you have in mind that would merit its being called glorious. It seems like to some extent, the book just ends without us seeing any good thing that results. But I think certainly in Priam's own voice, and maybe in Achilles' own opinion too, although he's much less explicit about this, they're not happy to have had this insight.
Right? It's not a happy thing.
Yeah, right.
It's teaching you something, and that something is not happy. I mean, mm-hmm. you know. And I agree with you that there's not a nice, like, bows on at the end inside, but the reader is left with this tragic sense, and that's Homer as teacher of, you get the same thing in Oedipus in a way, or something of this kind, maybe. I don't know. That's just I just wanted to present an alternative to the, and I know we're going to the Odyssey and all that, but I just wanted to present a kind of alternative to this notion of pity and all this sort of thing.
There's also, I mean, grief is a really weird thing, right? Like, I was talking to a buddy of mine recently about this, where it's like, you've got this sadness, right? You've got sadness, which is this huge spectrum of stuff, right? That can be everything from stubbing your toe to like having the person you love the most in the world die, right? But that subset thing of grief, I feel like, is just incredibly profound. And so it makes a certain amount of sense to me that, in your question, Jeff, of why does he give the body back? Of when you experience grief, like something changes. Your normal operating system and how you respond to stimuli changes once you experience grief, right? And it can be in a lot of different ways. And it is true in, and Shay talks about this a lot in Odysseus in America and Achilles in Vietnam, of the berserker state, right? When somebody close to you dies, you just, if you're, in the military, if you are a warrior, you can go nuts and just use violence to just express that grief. But there's also this option, which is seeing another person grieving, recognizing their humanity, and going, how can I comfort this person because he is experiencing the same thing I am. And so I think it's a little bit of, the most profound experience of grief. And there's two like weird metaphors about that too, right? And I know Jeff loves a metaphor.
Is it where they wonder at one another, like a man who's committed murder and he shows up in another city?
There's right, yeah, there's that one, which is super, which just seems weird, because that's not what is happening, right? Like, Priam has not committed a murder and is going back to, oh, it's in 23, and it's Achilles, it's around 220, and it's like all night long they beat upon the flames together, blowing shrieking blasts, and all night long swift Achilles from his golden mixing bowl, two-handled cup in hand, drew out the wine and poured it on the ground and soaked the earth, calling on the soul of poor Patroclus. As a father weeps as he burns the bones of his newly married son, whose dying brings grief to his wretched parents, so Achilles wept as he burned the bones of his companion. Which that just seems a little weird because that doesn't seem like, to me, the relationship between Achilles and Patroclus doesn't seem like a father and a son, and especially a son who's about to get married. So that's weird metaphor number one back in 23. And the other one is the one you mentioned of Priam being a murderer and coming in to, plead for sanctuary. It seems like almost, are those switched to some degree? Because I could see Priam, weeping like it's his son on his wedding night, because that is the relate it's Hector is his son. There's something in that metaphor about Priam that is reminiscent of the backstory that we get in the beginning of 24, which is how Patroclus ended up as Achilles' companion, that he murdered someone in his home city and then had to go to Achilles for sanctuary. So the metaphors are confusing me, is kind of the other piece of this. So I don't know. I guess I just wanted to muddy the waters a little bit because I think you guys were getting very Nietzschean, even though I don't know how, because you guys are much better at Nietzsche than I am.
Well, no, this might be evidence in favor of Shiloh's way of interpreting the details, though. So maybe we can look at the second one. The first one, I think the way to pursue it would be to say, well, there is some kind of inequality between Achilles and Patroclus. And maybe one of the things the simile is capturing is that Patroclus was an inferior to Achilles, but also a necessary complement because he was supposed to watch what Achilles did, right? The two of them were going to sack Troy together, presumably with Achilles doing most of the heavy lifting. And there's some sense in which a son is witness to and then can carry on what the father does. So I can see some sense in the first one. But just to concentrate on the second one for a minute, because, you know, it might go in Shiloh's direction, and I think in your direction too, Brian, and away from where I was thinking. It's around 480, and the simile follows immediately on this very striking moment where Priam kisses the hands of Achilles, the hands that killed Hector, and, you know, presumably several of his other sons. And then here's what Homer says. "And as when overpowering blindness of heart comes on a man, who in his own country slays another and escapes to a land of strangers, to the house of some man of substance, and amazement comes on those who look at him, so was Achilles struck with wonder at sight of godlike Priam, and struck with wonder were the others likewise, and they glanced at one another." There are a couple attendants present. And you're absolutely right that part of the puzzle of this simile is it looks like, you know, Achilles is the killer here, but it looks like Priam is like a killer who showed up for sanctuary in a foreign country. Maybe if we can unpack what's wondrous in that sight, that might go towards saying what's edifying about us being able to watch the tragedy of the tragic realization of these two people.
So you're saying, why is Priam described that way?
Mm.
What? Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it points in the direction of a certain kind of moral chaos. Because, in fact, he's not a killer, and he's far from, but he's actually a rescuer. Mm-hmm. And a fairly gentle old man. So that he could be likened to this, you're saying, is that if we could figure that out, we would be able to say in what the wonder lies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just going to say, like, what is the, to introduce a post-Homeric term, what is the sin of Priam? What is the thing that, what crime has he committed? What moral crime has he committed that has made him like this murderer pleading with, specifically at a rich man's house, which I thought was interesting too, that it was at a rich man's house that he is pleading for sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is the idea that the war is his fault in part and he could have stopped it? Or what? I mean, that would make him a murderer.
Hmm.
Well, I liked your idea, Shiloh, of you know, Priam being a gentle old man, because Paris and Priam don't seem, except for Paris's lack of ability to beget a son or a child at all in 20 years of being with Helen, whereas Priam has just got sons everywhere. That personality-wise, I feel like Paris and Priam are more similar than Hector and Priam.
Yeah. Yeah, that Priam indulges Paris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although he's sober-minded enough to see that his other sons are a bunch of like jokers and jesters.
Right.
Like, he's not such a pushover.
Yeah.
That he would equally rank them with Hector.
Sometimes an author will put something in a character's, you know, give a character a line, and it seems like it makes sense, but then you got to think about who said the line a little bit more. And so, like, to some degree, I wonder how much Priam's, you know, liars and dancers line is, you know, a little bit of like those kids with their TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it's an old guy just lamenting, you know, these kids with their rock and roll kind of thing. I'm not saying that that's all of it. It's a, you know, just is a shade of a part of a, you know, the thing that we're wrestling with.
Yeah. I mean, he is going to die because of the incapacity of his remaining sons, I think in part. I mean, but yeah, so, I like the direction we're going in though, that he has behaved, Priam has behaved in a way that in principle gives him no country. And yet he's showing up to Achilles as if Achilles could offer him a country. I think that might be the terms of likeness with the murder, right? You commit a murder, then everybody should bar their doors to you. but you show up at somebody else's place and they give you sanctuary, it's astonishing. You know, you're a person that should belong nowhere, but you're claiming or asking to be accepted here. And that's wondrous. But I thought, Shiloh, you were going to say something.
Well, I maybe a couple different things. I may have lost one of them, but it's true that Achilles does tell him, if the Achaeans see you, they'll kill you. So you better stay. You know what I mean? I mean, this goes to your point. But I was just thinking, I mean, if we think about the wonder, and I was just sort of thinking about what I had said earlier. I guess to try to make a more precise formulation, just that men can be causes of such destruction is itself an insight worthy of marveling at. Because as you read the Iliad as a reader, that comes up on occasion. It's unclear what the causes are, right? Is it the gods? Is it the men? And I'm not sure at the end what the causes are. But the men seem to think that it's the men, at least in some respects. The women seem maybe to think it's the men too. I'm not sure. But just the notion that men can be causes of such destruction, that this is a dimension of human life, that if that Priam and Agamemnon would have been equally capable of fighting this long war as they would have been of making a truce. I mean, there's no necessity that prevents that, were they both to be emotionally on the same page. But that's not what happened. And all of this, at least in theory, could have been avoided, and the outcome isn't necessary. We were the causes. That's incredible if you really think about that. if you really think about the power that men have to wreak havoc on their own lives unknowingly for the sake of ends which, once they are obtained, whether it's justice or, the body back, the girl back, seem cheap compared to the cost of obtaining the ends. That is a tragic situation. That is a, and that's not, as you're, as you are, as you reader are reading through the Iliad, you're kind of not thinking about that. You're like, yeah, this is a really cool scene, and you're not in it the way they're not in it. But there comes a moment when both the reader and the characters sort of see that this is all, wow. Do we just, did that just happen? That could have been different. And now, we're all being eaten by dogs and our wives are lamenting and we're stuck halfway from, across the world from home, whatever the case may be. And so that seems to me to be, at least a dimension of, what's being communicated here at the end. The wondrous thing. And the men look like children. I mean, Priam and Achilles look in a way like children. It's just, you think this is cheap, at least. I mean, I know that you can read it, and I think Brian, and I do too, where you're moved in these men and they're reconciling. But on the other hand, it feels cheap considering the massive scale of events that have preceded it.
Yeah, Andromache captures this pretty well in her kind of final speech, where she says, "Oh Hector, you're dead. You're dead from defending the city, and now I'm gonna have to do shameful things, and your son is gonna have to do shameful things, and maybe your son is gonna be thrown from the battlements by some Greek who's angry because his father was killed by, Hector or something like that." So the sense that what in a kind of narrow perspective is Hector's very admirable defense of the city and attempt to drive the Greeks off has these repercussions that just turn into this shameful suffering for his wife and child, indefinitely into the future, right? Who knows how it's going to end?
Yeah, and that and I think that is even further down the causal chain from just the vanity of Paris and Helen. Like you look back and you think all of this for that? I mean, and so that is a human, if you could sustain that insight at every moment of your life, the world would appear, I don't know, rich and terrifying, and it would be like turned up to 50, the whole time. But you don't sustain that. But when you do, you begin to open a tear into wisdom or something of that nature.
I mean, it seems like wisdom is the exception, not the rule, right? And especially in this last piece, because Achilles and Priam aren't. Looking at it and stepping back, it's like, oh, this is a wise move by Achilles. This is good foreign policy. But to a certain extent, how much is it to do with seeing an old man cry at your feet? And realizing that violence is right outside the tent. And just that combination of emotion and threat of violence might be as much of a factor in the decision making of Achilles in this moment, as well as what you mentioned, Shiloh, in terms of Helen and Paris's decision to, book back to Troy, and Agamemnon's decision to raise an army to sacrifice his daughter in order to get him there. And so it seems like that this is, showing us to a certain degree this whole book that wisdom is maybe rare, and that emotion and men's proclivity to violence is more the rule.
And the god in the gods, oh, go ahead. The gods have no access to that. I mean, I assume the gods, I mean, in a way, the men are the gods, because the gods, like, I can't imagine that Zeus and Athena and Hera just all go home and, I mean, and are wailing, you know. I mean, they're probably like, all right, well, what are we going to do tomorrow? This thing looks like it's shutting down. Like, what's next? Like, we got to go cause some more. And so there's this way in which the human, I mean, we've talked about mortality and what does it mean that the gods don't die and that they use the human beings like playthings. But there's a way in which the human at the end becomes, I mean, for my money, superior to the gods, insofar as the thing that I described earlier, the gods don't have access to. It's not in their in their moral, psychic cosmos, because they don't experience the loss, and they wouldn't look back on what they've done and say, well, what hell we have wrought, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is being a god just meaning not having any regrets?
Being a god is never having to say you're sorry. Yeah. Well, it does seem like in some ways we have teed up the Odyssey, right? If there's an experience here that maybe not for the people who are undergoing it, right? Priam and Achilles, but for the people who are watching somebody undergo it, there's an experience here that makes possible a wisdom. Maybe the person who has that wisdom needs to be depicted next, and then, or the person who's pursuing that wisdom, and then we need to see what that kind of human being looks like as that possibility is played out. Because I do think that the possibility that Achilles and Priam are, especially the possibility that Achilles is, has been played out over this book.
Well, that might be a good time to end. Fellas, we did it. That's the Iliad.
Woo-hoo!
So thank you, Shiloh. Thank you,
Yeah,
Jeff. Thank you,
pleasure.
dear listener, for
Yeah.
taking this journey with us. And check us out, combatandclassics.org. You can donate over there, support the show. You can follow us on social. I got to read the last line.
Let's
I
hear it.
like it so
Let's
much.
hear it. You promised.
Then, having come together, they duly gave a glorious feast in the house of Priam, king nurtured by Zeus. Thus they tended the funeral of Hector, breaker of horses. It's just a great last line. It is a great last line. Get this guy a sequel. He's got this one. Like, this is gonna sell like crazy. Get him back in the writer's room for another one. We need it. All right. Thanks, fellas.
Yeah, thank you both. This has been a great, great project. Thanks so much.